Okay, we'll get started again.
So when you're ready to go, you just hit start recording, right?
So in some ways, this next talk could have gone at the beginning, because this comes to the issue of all the two previous talks have basically started with you've collected your data, you have your design, what's the best way to analyze that data, accounting for all the issues of variable hemodynamic response and other structured noise and other aspects. But stepping back, there is the important issue of what is the optimal design in the first place before you actually collect your data when you're planning your experiment. It's better to put this talk after these two, because you do need kind of to set up the GLM and there's a little bit of math and the like. But Tom Liu has done some influential publications on this topic, and so he's going to guide us through how to pick the best design.
Great, thanks, Tom.
That's high.
That's high. Is that good? Okay.
Let's start recording.
All right. Okay. Good morning. So as Tom said, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we call optimization of designs for fMRI. So I thought it's always good to start off with a definition of what we're going to talk about. So I went to dictionary.com and looked up the word optimize. And there's a number of definitions. To make it effective as possible. I like this one, to be optimistic. That might be good for this talk. And also, Steve, you're in the audience. Optimize, this is for you, the British spelling of optimize. Okay. So what we're going to talk about today is making as effective, perfect, or as useful as possible, with the stress on useful. Okay, so why optimize? Well, those of you who've been doing fMRI know that scanner time is expensive. Subjects can be difficult to find. If you're doing a special patient population, you might have to fly them in from across the country. You might only have them for one day. And if you screw up the design, you may not get good data. As Steve and Martin have talked about, fMRI data are noisy. And so a badly designed experiment is unlikely to yield publishable results. Okay. Finally, time equals money. And I like this one. If you're resulting a statistician, this apologies to Tom, then you should design a better experiment, okay? So, you know, all of us have done this. Sometimes your data is just right on the edge, you know, and you're tweaking your statistics to get that p of 0.05 threshold. Really, you should go back and do a better experiment, okay? So hopefully this talk will help you do that a little bit. So what do we want to optimize? I'm just going to talk about two things, and mostly I'm going to talk about the first one, is statistical efficiency, which is basically maximizing the contrast of interest versus your noise. So it's a very simple concept. I'll spend just a few minutes talking about something that's equally as important, but it's not sort of amenable to mathematics, which is psychological factors, which is actually very important, but we'll spend just a few minutes talking on that. Okay, so here's the basic question. What I'm showing you here are five different designs, okay? So these dashes here represent when I'm showing the stimulus, okay? So I can have a random design, a block design, what we call periodic single trial design, or things in between, okay? I think there's a possibility here, button this up so my thing stays up. So there's a possibility of like 2 to the 100th designs possible, okay? So the question is, out of those 2 to the 100 designs, which ones should you pick? And the answer is, it depends, okay? It actually depends on the experimental question, which design you should pick. So some of the questions you might ask, one traditionally people ask is, where is the activation? What are areas of the brain lit up? But you might also say, well, I already know where the activation is. I'm looking at visual cortex or I'm looking at auditory cortex. What I want to know is, what does the hematic response look like? And for example, does it differ with disease or age or drugs? So implicit in that are some model assumptions. One is, we can assume we know the shape. The work that Steve and Martin were saying is showing that there are canonical shapes that are assumed. And just saying, we'll assume a shape and we're going to look for the activation. But we don't know its amplitude, and the activation is related to its amplitude. We can assume that we don't know anything about the shape, and this is the FR model that Steve and Martin talked about, so we don't either know its shape or its amplitude. And in between, this is related to also the basis function approaches and the smoothness they were talking about, is we actually know something about the HRF. There have been hundreds of fMRI papers published now and lots of data sets, and we all agree that pretty much the HRF is smooth. HRF here stands for hemodynamic response function. Okay, so here's the general inner model that has been discussed before. And basically, we have our data that we measure. We have some design matrix, which tells us what our design was. We have our parameters of interest. Okay. We can have a nuisance matrix, which will include things like motion or physiological noise or drift. And then we have noise. So let's assume that we assume a shape. Okay, so this is our stimulus. And we're going to convolve it with our hemodynamic response function. And so the general inner model would like look like this. Basically, the first column here is this convolved stimulus, okay, multiplied by some parameter. So this is our design matrix here. This is our amplitude that we're trying to estimate. And then these are our nuisance terms. Whoops, let me go back. And these are our nuisance terms. So for example, mean term, a linear trend that's increasing with some unknown parameters, and then additive noise. And so this is courtesy, I think, of Russ or Steve, I'm not sure, one of you guys. Basically, the idea is we assume a shape for the HRF, then we can convolve it with our design, and that leads to this convolved response. Okay, and what we're going to be doing is looking for the amplitude of that response. Now, the other approach we can take is we can assume that we actually have no idea. So we go from one parameter to, say, let's say, four parameters, where we're trying to now estimate the shape of the response, where these four parameters are going to tell us something about the shape. So in this case, what we do is we have a stimulus. We multiply it by the first unknown parameter. We then shift that stimulus, multiply it by the second unknown parameter, and so on and so forth. And so in the GLM, you can see that the design matrix now is just our stimulus and shifted versions of our stimulus. So the important thing to notice about this design matrix is it depends only on the stimulus. Okay, we made no assumptions about the shape of our response, because that's what we're going to estimate over here. All right, so we've really backed off on our assumptions. And then we have these are the unknown shape and amplitude parameters now. And then these are our nuisance terms and additive noise. Okay, so this is an example of a design matrix where you can see that if you go down one of these columns, that's the stimulus, and then you have shifted versions of your stimulus. Okay? And this one might be an estimate of your hemodynamic response that you get. Okay, in this case, they were 12 parameters that were estimated. And then as Steve alluded to, the third thing is that you can actually assume something about the shape. So you can say that your hemodynamic response H is some linear combination of basis functions, where the columns of this B matrix are your basis functions. So in this case, I took four basis functions. And if you just randomly assign an amplitude to each of these five basis functions and sum them up, these are five random HDR hemodynamic responses you would get using these basis functions. Okay. So because we've sort of imposed this constraint that our response must be made of these basis functions, our end result is also going to be fairly smooth and actually look like a reasonable hemodynamic response. Okay. Now, if we had said, well, actually, we know nothing about the hemodynamic response and took five random hemodynamic responses, which is each of these would be like a random vector of 19 points, then these would be our candidate hemodynamic responses, okay? Which is obviously goes against the a priori knowledge we have, which none of these really look like a real hemodynamic response. No one would call... You wouldn't publish a paper saying this is my hemodynamic response. Okay. So the basis function approach, or putting some assumptions about the shape, is going to be very helpful. Okay, so to get a little more quantitative about it, pretty much everything we do in fMRI or in science in general comes down to a test statistic. Okay. So there's going to be some parameter that you're estimating, and you can divide by the standard deviation of that estimate. So in fMRI, the parameter of estimate is typically the size of the bulk response. And that's going to depend on your stimulus. You know, what was the contrast of your stimulus, the neural activity, the field strength, and the vascular state. Okay, these are pretty much things that you know, you don't have too much control of. You can control the stimulus. And these other things are pretty much what nature is giving us, or your physicist is giving you.
Okay.
And you divide that by the noise. So you have thermal noise, physiological noise, low frequency drifts and motion, and scanner artifacts and other things. Okay. So once again, you don't have too much control over these. You can try to take out some of the physiological noise. You can bug your physicist to make your scan cleaner. The thing though, that is this bottom term also, this variance of your estimate also depends on experimental design. And so that's something that we do have some control over, and that's what we want to talk about. Okay, so what we're going to do is, for this talk, our definition of efficiency is simply it's going to be 1 over the variance of the parameter estimate, okay? Which makes sense. So a more efficient design is going to have less variance. As the variance goes up, the efficiency is going to go down. If we have a parameter h hat and look at its covariance matrix, then simply what we're going to do is we're going to take some of the diagonal terms, which are the variance of each of those components. Say this has n components in that estimate. And so efficiency is simply 1 over the trace of the covariance matrix. Okay. And if we do that, then this is what's known as an a-optimal design. There's other approaches we could take, but this is sort of the simplest one to deal with. Okay, so for example 1, we just had 1 estimate, which was the unknown amplitude. And in that case, our efficiency is just 1 over the variance of that estimate of the amplitude. For example 2, we had 4 unknown parameters, and so in that case, the efficiency is 1 over the sum of those variances. Okay, and so you can see that there's sort of a fundamental difference in terms of whether we're going to try to look at the variance of one thing or the variance of more than one thing. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at this, but I think a really nice way is sort of a geometric point of view. Okay, and this gets back to the fundamental question of what does a matrix do? Right? Most of us have done a lot of matrix multiplication, but if you actually stop to think what a matrix does, it's sort of interesting. So what I'm showing you here is just the general linear model about the nuisance term and noise. And essentially, a matrix takes us from a k-dimensional vector. Okay, so let's say we have 20 points in our HMAC response. That'd be 20 points. An n by k multiplying by an n by k matrix, so that's maybe like a 200 by 20 matrix. And that will give us a 200 dimensional vector. So it's really taking us from a k dimensional space, a 20 dimensional space, into a 200 dimensional space. Okay, so it's a transformation between different spaces. And what does that transformation look like? Well, it turns out that what a vector does is you can imagine if you had a sphere in your original space. Okay, so let's say this is just a 2D space, so it's just a circle. Okay, I imagine a unit circle in my 2D space. What every matrix multiplication does is it takes that unit sphere and warps it into an ellipse, or in higher dimensions, a hyperellipse. Okay, so every matrix does that. So let's think about, so the singular value decomposition some of you may be familiar with, is a nice way of, it's sort of based on that geometric understanding of what matrices do. And what a singular value decomposition does is it orthogonalizes your original space into, let's say in this case, 2 singular vectors, v1 and v2, which are orthogonal, which means they're perpendicular. And then it takes each one of those vectors, okay, and then, so x times v1, so the matrix x times one of those singular vectors equals a singular value times a vector in your other space. Okay, so that looks like this. So for example, this matrix takes V1 and transforms it into sigma 1 times mu 1. Okay, and then it takes V2 and transforms it into sigma 2 mu 2. Okay, so you can think of it as sort of it amplifies each of these vectors by the singular value. So that's just saying that in words. So why does that matter? Well, and then it also turns out that the singular values are given by the square roots of the eigenvalues of this matrix X transpose X. So given if we know what the matrix is, we can clearly compute this, we can compute the eigenvalues, and those are the singular values. So we can tell what every matrix is going to do to a unit sphere. Okay, so how does this apply to fMRI? Well, let's assume that we're going to assume a shape. Okay? So this is a two-dimensional space here, and there should be a V2 there. I think I dropped it. Let's assume we know what the shape of the response is. So we're going to assume that there's some vector, H0, which describes the shape of our response. Okay, so we're saying, I actually know what the shape of my response is. Okay. Then I'm going to multiply by my data is just going to be my vector times my matrix. That's going to take this singular vector and make it into this vector in the data space. And it's also going to take my assumed response and multiply it by something that's sort of close to that. Okay. So here's the idea. If I have something in my parameter space, I'm going to want to try to amplify it as much as possible. Okay, because I want to make things as big as possible, because I want to have the biggest signal to detect as possible. So I want to choose my design such that my H0 is going to be pretty close to whatever vector is pretty close to one of these singular vectors, and in particular the singular vector that has the biggest sigma 1. Okay, I want it to be next to the singular vector that has the biggest singular value, so it amplifies that vector as much as possible. Okay, so if I assume a shape, my ideal matrix is going to take a circle into an ellipse. And I want to make that ellipse as skinny as possible. Okay. So efficiency in this case is optimized by amplifying the singular vector closest to the assumed HEMDAC response. And that means we're going to really try to make sigma 1 really big and all the other sigmas really small. The other thing we can do is look back in the noise parameter space. What that will tend to do is, if we're making something really big in our data space, then compared to the noise, if we think about the noise, then the noise compared to it is very small. Okay, so we can think about, if I have this ellipse in the data space, then back in parameter space, the noise sort of looks like this. It's small in the direction perpendicular to where I have the biggest amplification. So this is obviously going to be good for if you know the shape, you just want to amplify, go in the direction you know is good, and forget about all the other directions. Okay. Now let's say I don't assume a shape. Okay. So in this case, I have no idea where my vector is. It could be pointing in any direction. I'm saying I have no idea what the shape of my response is. So therefore, if I pick any direction, I could be helping that direction but hurting other directions. So if I have no idea what the direction is, what I should do is I should go from a circle to a circle or sphere to sphere, because I don't have any assumptions, so I need to treat all directions equally. Okay, and if I do that, then also my noise will be symmetric. And so this means that if I make no assumptions, then I want the matrix that will take me from a circle to a circle. Now let's say I have some assumptions about the shape. So remember, if we have no assumptions, then I go from a sphere to a sphere. So in this case, it's a three-dimensional sphere to a three-dimensional sphere. But now let's say I say, well, actually, I do know something about my vector. And just as a cartoon example, let's say I say, well, my vector can only lie on this two-dimensional circle. Okay, out of all the possible HEMDAC responses, I know that this is too big of a space, so I'm going to limit myself to this circle. Okay? So therefore, what I should do is find the matrix that within this plane takes a circle to a circle, okay, but orthogonal to this plane doesn't amplify anything at all. Okay? So I want to find the matrix that only operates sort of in this plane and that doesn't do anything orthogonal to that. Because if I assume that my vector can't lie here, then I'm wasting my energy by amplifying anything out here. Okay? So if we know that the HEMDAC response lies in a subspace spanned by, say, a set of basis functions, then what we really want to do is we want to maximize the singular values such that it amplifies everything in that subspace, and we sort of ignore everything out of that subspace. Okay, so here's the sort of summary of it. If I assume nothing about my human response, then I want to make the singular values as equal as possible. I want to go from a sphere to a sphere. If I assume something about my human response, then all I want to do is maximize one direction and go from like a sphere to an ellipse. And then if I want to sort of be somewhere in between, then I want to just maximize it within some subspace. Okay, now it turns out that the singular values have a really nice relationship to the power spectrum. And we're not going to, do this very high level of detail, but remember the singular values are the square roots of the eigenvalues of this matrix here, X transpose X. Okay? And X transpose X, if you think about sort of the first component, it's sort of like the first row of X multiplied by the first column. And so it's sort of like multiplying the design by itself. Okay, so it's going to do an autocorrelation of the design. All right? And it turns out that the eigenvalues of this matrix actually approach the power spectrum of our design. Okay, there's a fundamental relationship in mathematics and also quite often using signal processing where if you know the eigenvalues of this matrix, you also know what the power spectrum is. Okay, it turns out because this is an almost circular matrix, okay, a circular matrix, so it has the eigenvectors tend to be the complex exponentials, okay, which are the Fourier transform. That's what you need for Fourier transforms. So it just turns out that if you know that the eigenvalues, then you also know the power spectrum. And so if we go back to this picture again, if I know nothing about my response, then I want to distribute my eigenvalues equally, and that corresponds to a flat power spectrum. Okay? So it means I'm looking for designs that have a flat power spectrum. If I have one dominant singular value, that means I'm going to have one dominant power spectral component, and that would correspond to design with this power spectrum. And then if I have a set of dominant singular values, and not just one, but maybe a subset of them, then I'm going to want to spread my power spectral components sort of around some band. Okay, so this has sort of been known sort of, this is common folklore in fMRI literature, so that, for example, if I know what my design is, and then I convolve it to get my boxcar regressor, then that corresponds to a frequency spectrum that's pretty pointed. Okay, it's got most of its energy at the fundamental frequency. So this is a design that has pretty much one dominant singular value and one dominant power spectral component, because I've assumed I know what the PMAC response is. On the other hand, if I do a randomized design, okay, then it's going to have a pretty spread out power spectrum. And so this is a design that has spread out singular values. It's going to try to amplify vectors in every direction, and it's also going to spread the energy over frequencies. Okay, so this sort of makes sense. If I know, if I don't really know the shape of my response, then I need to sort of probe every frequency possible. Okay, so now we can get back to the question of which is the best design. All right. So we have a selection here of five different designs. And so the first question is, given assumed shape, h sub 0, which design is going to maximize x times h 0? So x times h 0 is convolving my stimulus with my hearing response. And remember, that's the geometric picture, is taking some h naught and making it as big as possible after I multiply by my main matrix. Okay. So what we're looking for is which of these responses, if you sort of think about taking out the mean, is sort of got its big, the biggest amplitude on average. Okay. So this is sort of, varying around its mean, and this one is varying a lot around its mean. Okay. So this is going to be the design that really sort of maximizes how big that response is. Which is sort of the same thing as maximizing how big that vector is. On the other hand, let's say we don't know anything about our Emax response, then the question is which design is going to have the most equal spread of singular values, or equivalently, which is going to have the flattest power spectrum, so either equal singular values or a flat power spectrum. And so if we look at these, essentially, all we're looking at is which of these designs, we can actually ignore the responses now. We're just looking at the designs now. Which of these designs is going to have the broadest power spectrum? Okay. And it turns out those from physics, you know that, for example, a white noise process has a flat power spectrum. So we're going to be looking for the most random design, which is clearly A.
Okay.
So if you know nothing about your response, then you want to go with the most random design, the one with the most power spread out over all possible dimensions. And finally, let's say we know something about our shape. Okay, we know that it's smooth. And so the question is, which design is going to have a tailored spread of singular values, or which is going to have a shaped power spectrum? So either something where we've gone from a three to a two-dimensional subspace, or we've got some shaped response. Okay. So it can't be A, because we already said that was, you know, we knew nothing. It's obviously not D, because we know that this is sort of going to amplify things. So we know it's got to be either B or C. So the question is, which one is it? Okay. And the answer is, it could be either one, depending on what your assumptions are. Okay, both of these are going to spread the energy a little differently. Depending on what your assumptions are, you're going to, one of these is going to be better for you. Okay, so I've been using the term efficiency, but what I want to do to present some additional graphs is also use a term that we call detection power, which is essentially just a name for efficiency, but just for efficiency in a particular case, which is when we think about detection, okay, we typically want to answer a question of, is something present or not? Okay, when you think about detecting something, if you want to find something, then you have to identify a target beforehand, because you have to know whether you saw what you wanted to see. Okay, so for example, if you're an AWACS plane, you need to know what kind of MiG fighter you're going after, or something like that. Okay, so you need to find what exact plane you're looking for. That's your target, because you're not just looking for any plane, you're looking for a particular plane. Okay? So in fMRI, our target is if we say we know what the shape is, and we're going to assume that our target is the convolution of that stimulus with this hemic response, then this really is our target. We're looking for voxels that look like that, okay? That have a time course that goes up and down with our design. And so once we've specified our target, we've really locked in our assumption, then what we can, it's convenient to call the efficiency for estimating the amplitude of that target our detection power. That's our ability to detect that target. So there's going to be a theoretical, so we call detection power sort of our ability to detect an activation when we assume the shape versus our estimation efficiency where we assume that we don't know the shape. It turns out that there's just a fundamental trade-off between the two. Okay, there's no way you can get maximize both at the same time. Right? And that's really to the fact that, remember, if we want to estimate this efficiency here, or we assume we know nothing about the shape, we have to make the singular values equal. We have to spread the energy out. Whereas here, we're going to have one dominant singular value. Okay, we're going to just really focus on amplifying one direction. And clearly, we can't do both at the same time. Okay, this is equally spread. This is not equally spread. Okay, so there is this fundamental trade-off that you have to live with. Okay, you can't get both. And practically also, it's sometimes very hard to sort of make your singular vector align with your assumed shape. And so in practice, you find that you can't even do the theoretical maximum. You can only maybe get 50 or 60% of the theoretical maximum. So this is shown here. These are theoretical curves, which basically I'm plotting efficiency versus power and just showing you that these trade-off curves that you have to live with. You can either really estimate your shape well or you can detect it well, but you can't do both at the same time. This is just another view where, for example, we're showing the random sequence is very good at estimating the shape, not so good. It's only about 20% of the maximum at estimating detecting something. And whereas the block design here is pretty good at detecting, so it's around 50% of the maximum, theoretical maximum, very poor for estimating efficiency. You can't really estimate the shape very well when you have a block design. And then there's these intermediate designs that we'll talk about later, which sort of allow you a trade-off between the two, that you could maybe give up some of your efficiency in this case, give up 20% of your efficiency, but really double your detection power. Now, if you're willing to assume that there's basis functions, then these were the curves, these were the previous curves here, where this is our efficiency, okay? And in this case, we're trying to estimate, say, 15 different parameters. We now go with basis functions, what we find is we really are doing a much better job of getting better efficiency here. Okay, so this is the efficiency if you assume that you're allowed to have basis functions, which is basically just saying, because you're trying to estimate less parameters. Okay, so your efficiency of each of those parameters is going to be much better. So there is a real advantage, I think, to using basis functions for your designs, and that's something that I think people will probably need to consider a little more carefully in terms of if you're going to design and looking at efficiency, you may want to think more about what basis functions are you willing to use for that experiment. Okay, so to sum up this part of the talk, if we make no assumption about the HRF, these are really experiments where you want to characterize in detail the shape. If you assume total knowledge of your HRF, then this is where you want to detect activation. And then I think a reasonable compromise between the two is detect activation when you sort of know the shape, and then you can also characterize the shape when you sort of know its properties. Okay, so I think this is actually probably a good way to go. One question is, if block designs are so good for detecting activation, why would you bother using any other sort of design? And the answer really comes about with sort of habituation and anticipation, and also just sort of the purpose of your experiment. So for example, if you're trying to decide, if you're trying to have people make a decision about something and you give them, ask them the same question, you know, 20 times in a row, they're probably just gonna give you the same answer 20 times in a row, okay? If you're, they'll sort of catch on to design. So they're gonna be anticipating your design. So you do want to, from a psychological point of view, you do want to go to something that's a little less predictable. So there's a lot of ways of looking at predictability, but one thing is just sort of using entropy as a measure of predictability. So this is really the perceived randomness of your design. How easily can your subject predict a design? So we use something called conditional entropy, which is really sort of how much new information is each stimulus giving you, where typically 2 to the entropy is a measure of sort of the average number of possible outcomes. So I'll just go through this very briefly. So for example, if you just had either an A event or a null event, okay, then there's really only 2 outcomes, 2 possible outcomes if these are presented equally likely. And so that would be an entropy of 1 bit, since 2 to the 1 is 2 outcomes. If you had 4 equally likely outcomes, so A, B, C, or null, then that's 4, and each of those was equally likely, then you would have, since there's 4 outcomes, the maximum entropy is 2 bits, since 2 to the 2 equals 4. Now, if this was a little more predictable, then the number of bits would go down. Okay, so if, for example, if this was more predictable, instead of having 2 bits of entropy, this might only have 1 bit of entropy. So this is just an example of how you might think about these. These are what's called an M sequence, which is a nice random sequence. And then, as you can see, the entropy here is about 3. And then as I go to sort of more and more structured designs, the entropy goes from, say, 3 to 2.74. And in addition, if I look at the entropy over time for this design, it's pretty good entropy here, but then it falls off significantly as the design becomes more predictable. Okay. So there are, I think it is useful to, when you're looking at designs, to look at, to get some sense of how random it is. But the question of how much randomness you need psychologically, I think, is still somewhat of an open question. Okay, I think I'll skip over that in the interest of time. Now, everything I've talked about for now was sort of mapped out, assuming that we just had one trial type, say A, and a control event, say null. So, like, you turn something on or off. It turns out that everything I've talked about also applies to what we call multiple trial types, which is what most of you will be doing, which is you might have 2 different trial types in a null, so A, B, A, B, and A. Or you might have 4 different trial types in a null event. Okay, so different conditions. It turns out you can just expand your general linear model to so that every trial type has its own design matrix and also has its own parameter vector. So you can just expand your GLM, and now for your sort of efficiency, you're going to look at the average variance of all the estimates for all the trial types, but also all the pairwise contrasts, because you're going to want to determine whether there's a difference between A and B, B and C, and so forth. It turns out that these are graphs showing the trade-off between efficiency and power for 2, 3, 4, and 5 trial types. It turns out that, and these are the theoretical curves, okay, these are just simulations, where for 2, 3 trial types, it looks like, you know, that trade-off is there. As we increase the number of trial types from, say, 4 to 5 trial types, that trade-off is still there, but you notice it's much harder for us to get to the theoretical maximum. Okay. If this is the theoretical maximum here, the best we're doing is about 70% of that. Now here, and this is just picking an annual random design, here at 4 trial types, you notice that we're getting 80% of the maximum with a random design. We're coming much closer with something that's called an M sequence, or maximal length sequence. And so it's just sort of showing you that, that you've got to go through some extra sort of steps to try to get to the theoretical maximum as the number of trial types increases. And that makes sense because your space of possible designs is increasing rapidly. Say, this is 2 to the 100 possible designs. This is 5 to the 100 possible designs. Okay, so many more designs that you have to search over. The optimal frequency also becomes sort of an issue that you can play around with, which is that if you have 2 trial types, okay, and a null, the question is how often should you show each one? If you only care about the contrast of each one between the two, then you should just show A, B, A, B. Okay? If you only care about the trials, A and B individually, then you should show each one with a probability of 30%. But if you care about all trials and all possible pairwise contrast, then you should show each one a third of the time, which is sort of what you would expect from common sense, which is show the A a third of the time, the B a third of the time, the null about a third of the time. Okay. If not, but if you have some other choice, you can use this complicated equation that's we derived. Okay, so as I alluded to, as the number of trial types increases, it becomes really hard to get the theoretical maximums and to really optimize your design. And random search becomes basically impractical. If you have an unknown shape, then it seems like you should use an M-sequence-based design. I'll talk about that a little bit. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to end the talk really talking about some different approaches for trying to come close to the theoretical maximum. So M-sequences are something that have been around for over 50 years. They're used in all your CDMA cell phones, okay, spread spectrum communications. And they've been used in vision research for a while. They were first introduced to fMRI by Dietrich Barakas. And he showed that these are designs that they're deterministic in the sense that you can program them in with a circuit, yet when you look at them, they look almost random. Okay. So when we look at these designs here, what we find is this is the maximum theoretical efficiency of 1. You can do no better than that theoretically. M sequences going from, say, 1 to 12 trial types are basically within 3% of the maximum. Okay? So if you really want to assume nothing about your shape, then it suggests that you should start off with an M sequence. It's always, especially as you go to more and more trial types, you probably don't want to start with a random sequence because you can pick a really bad random sequence. So you do want to start off with a known good sequence. And so you can start off with M sequences. One thing we've done is you start off with an M sequence, and then you basically do a sort of iterative process where you try to make it a little more clumpy. Okay, let's say you don't want something totally random, but you want to start off with a good random design and then sort of make it progressively less random. You can sort of come up with an iterative process like that, and then sort of as you're going along, look at how good each design is. The other approach that Tor Wager and Tom Nichols proposed a few years ago is using genetic algorithms. Okay? And the idea here is you start off with some designs. They can either be some known good designs, or some random designs, and you just let them sort of crossbreed, produce new generations, and you just, for each generation, you see how good the designs are. You keep the best of each generation, and basically apply sort of Darwinian logic to your fMRI designs. Okay. And so this was the from their paper where they were starting off with some designs, looking at how good each design was, selecting the best designs, and then keeping some of those, but also, you know, marrying some of them. You know, and this could be something as simple as you take a design, you take half of that design, and mix it with half of another design. And so what they found was that, for example, in looking at efficiency, this is the best you could do with random design with some variance around it. And using a genetic algorithm, they did much, much better. Okay. So it turns out that this might be a very promising approach. And more recently, this is work from the University of Georgia. They've sort of done some modifications to the genetic algorithm. And they're actually finding, I haven't really looked closely at this work yet, but they're actually finding that. So these are the genetic algorithms here. Okay. This is the best you can do with an M sequence. This is the genetic algorithm from Tom and Tor's paper. And these are sort of a block design and some other design between an M sequence and a block design. So they're claiming that you can actually do much, much better than any of the previous art. Okay. Which is, I think it's going to take a little more work to decide if that's true, because simply we've just found that M sequence within sort of 3% of the theoretical maximum. This would indicate that they're going above the theoretical maximum. Okay. But if this is true, then I think that these genetic algorithms may turn out to be fairly useful, because they are very flexible. So some of the things we haven't covered are correlated noise, which Steve alluded to. This will change your optimal design, because if you know your noise is in a certain band, a frequency band, then you want to move away from that frequency band. So that will affect your design. We really haven't talked about nonlinearities in the bold response. That's touched a little bit in the genetic algorithms paper. Nonlinearities, everything we've assumed up to now is assumed a linear model. But once you go to nonlinear, once you take into account the nonlinearities, that can affect what the optimal design is. And I think the third thing is actually probably the widest open area, which is designs where the timing is constrained by psychology. And I think this is sort of one of the big open questions, which is we spend a lot of time sort of saying, well, these are the designs that will get you maximum theoretical efficiency from a mathematician's point of view. Okay. But oftentimes, these things are often not used. And the reason is because someone might come to say, well, I want to do a design where I want to have a subject study something, wait for 3 seconds, and do something else, and then wait for another 5 or 10 seconds. And all those timings are sort of built in from a psychological point of view. And so how do you design an optimal design within those constraints, I think, is still an area where more work can be done. Because once you build that in, then all this theoretical stuff just, it's nice to know, but it's really not applicable anymore. Okay? So I hope you sort of, so what we talked about is, really talking about efficiency is one place you might start for looking at your design performance. And really realizing that the efficiency is going to depend both on your design, but it also depends on the assumptions you make. Okay, so the best design for one assumption could be the worst design for another assumption. And finally, there is this inherent trade-off that you can't sort of have your cake and eat it too. You have to decide what it is that you actually care about. If you care about the shape, then you'll go for one design. For example, if you want to see if Alzheimer's disease slows down the shape of the response, then you need to go to the design that lets you estimate the shape. If, on the other hand, you don't care about the shape, okay, or you think you don't care about the shape, then you want to go to something more to the traditional block designs. And then in between, it's sort of the fuzzy area where I think there's more work that needs to be done, which is you sort of want everything because you want to be able to mine your data for everything. And then you also have these psychological constraints where, you know, the subject needs to have time to make decisions or do a task. Okay. So thanks for your attention.
I press it down.
Okay, questions for Tom?
Did you say a word about optimal design in parametric designs, where you care about, do you know what I mean by that?
You mean like making the rise time?
No, for example, you may have multiple, what you call multiple trial types.
Yeah.
But you may want to know if there is an area, let's say the trial types are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you want to know if there is an area that increases linearly with the trial type or something like that.
Yeah, I haven't really looked at that area in terms of parametric designs. So I would think that the starting point would be you just want to have a good estimate of each level and then go from there. But I don't know if there's a better approach to that.
You should just include the contrast when you're doing the that you're interested in when you're estimating your efficiencies.
Well, right. You could add sort of if you knew that's what you wanted. I guess you could just add a contrast. That's right.
Yeah, so if you want to make a contrast of different progressors, you can actually just reorganize your design matrix so you can actually turn the different regressors and the contrast into an effective regressor, which asks the contrast of interest, and then it's very easy to apply the same maths on that regressor.
Mark? Yeah, so in these pseudo-randomized sequences, I'm increasingly concerned that because the fold response is pretty non-linear, and certainly with respect to time invariance, the time between stimuli,
yeah,
that the models are probably skewed pretty badly in terms of the estimation of amplitude efficiency. Now, what if you've had any chance to try and incorporate these non-linear models, or at least estimates of the non-linearity, into these design efficiency questions?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and so I'll give you two answers. One is that one approach we thought about is sort of the Volterra kernel approach, so sort of modeling the non-linearities using the Friston approach. And so we've actually done that, and the interesting thing is, if you want things to be linear, give your subject caffeine. Okay. So we've actually found that if you give your subjects like a 200 milligram dose of caffeine, the estimate you come up with using a linear approach and a non-linear approach are almost the same. Whereas the subjects are in withdrawal, they're very non-linear. So, I mean, I'm sort of being sort of facetious there, but that's our preliminary data. It indicates that the linearity, and this is with a visual design where the spacing is like 1 second apart, and so you're really sort of, you're going to get the worst non-linearities possible. I think for a lot of cognitive paradigms, though, the spacing tends to be much further apart just due to cognitive, the psychological constraints. And so I think there the non-linearities actually become less of a problem. It's not like all the linear papers have really been using very rapid, visual things, and you're really enhancing the non-linearities. If you're doing something like, decision making, it's probably less of an issue, would be my guess. But probably very hard to show.
Another question?
Tom, you suggested we should put more emphasis on using basis expansions to try and get that intermediate range, I guess, the modeling the HRF. And the real issue there is smoothing, is it not? So you would include, for example, Barton's constrained FIR in that. Is that true?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand your suggestion.
Right. So I think one thing you could do is if you were... if you're using, say, D or 3D convol, after 3D convol, to estimate your efficiency, then it's probably good to then also put your assumptions about your shape into it so that, you're estimating the efficiency that you should actually care about. Because that will tend to pick a different design than if you had assumed no smoothness. Right? I mean, if you just assume no smoothness, then the answer would be just pick an M sequence.
Right, but is there any way to a priori say I want to go for a particular smoothness constraint? I guess that's in the choice of a finite basis.
I think that's where it comes to either using the FLOBS tool or... And that's one of the gray areas of fMRI is, how valid is that, especially if you're going into disease population, where there's vascular problems. Your assumption about the HRF might be completely wrong. And so you do need to be a little careful about that. And so I think it would be then, going over the sort of how much are you willing to assume about the HRF? I mean, I think we all agree it's smooth, but I think the timing can vary quite a lot.
Other question?
I had one. So what is it that prevents you from attaining the theoretical optimal power? I mean, if your driving function was a sinusoid, would you get optimal power, or is it something about the noise, or?
Yeah, that's right. If your driving function was a sinusoid,
okay, that, so that because would the HRF does not look like a sinusoid exactly,
right?
You can't.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
your model also had those nuisance parameters.
Yeah.
And you didn't address that with the optimizing X, right?
Right. That's an important consideration as well. So we do discuss that sort of in the papers that we've looked at. That has an impact in terms of, for example, if you're choosing a block design, then you know typically the folklore, which is pretty accurate, is you need four or five cycles to get good power. Okay, because if you pick something with just one cycle, then it's not very orthogonal to say linear drift, and then linear drift will eat up a lot of your power. So yeah, the nuisance terms do need to be considered. I just didn't have enough time to go into that. But even if you assume all you have is a mean term, you're still sort of constrained.
Okay. There are no other questions. We'll see you all back here at 2:00, and let's thank Tom one more time.